Well, welcome, folks, to the next edition of Valley Edition. Today, we have two of our three stalwart people in the studio, and we're hoping that the third will arrive soon. First, we have Terry Snyder, citizen lobbyist in her usual chair. We have Charles Hayes sitting in for Zaz Hollander. Zaz is off on a vacation. And we were expecting Mark Kelsey to come in, but as we are doing this, the winds are blowing at what appear to be 40 to 50 miles per hour. And we hope he's on his way. If not, we will do what we do with the two panelists before us. Last week, Friday, we started out with a brief reference to an event that has been now more revealed in detail, and that was the tragedy of the shooting in a school, an elementary school in Newtown, Connecticut. Now, since that time, there's more information that's been out, but also there has been the question raised, is there something that can or should be done to make sure that that kind of event doesn't occur here or, for that matter, anywhere else? So this is a broad topic, starting out with perhaps the governor's most recent response to it, which is that he was willing to engage in a discussion. Charles, what do you think?
Well, I think it's a very complicated subject. I think that we were doing just fine without assault weapons for years and years and years. There was a ban in 2004 that was repealed. I think with the amount of assault weapons in private ownership now, if they were banned immediately, it would be years before somebody that really wanted one couldn't get one if they tried. Speaking as an ex-cop, it's boggles the mind to think that you could go into neighborhoods and be confronted with numerous people with assault rifles. It's also an incredible mental health problem, and maybe even more so than the gun problem, because if you take a look at each one of these individuals that's been involved in these shootings, they were obviously mentally off track. So we've pretty much deleted budgets for mental health and hospitals the way it used to be. It's a very complicated problem, and I don't think anything that we do will, over the long term, satisfy everybody, because there are still going to be incidents. Maybe they won't be as severe. I don't know. But it remains to be seen whether we'll be able to halt assault weapons.
Mm-hmm. And assault weapons, of course, are one aspect of this whole thing, and it's both a political issue. Obviously, the delegation from Alaska to Washington, D.C. has what I refer to as taken a moment to think about. It hasn't launched yet into any particular support for either legislation or action. We know that there are many both political and economic issues all entangled here, because this is big business. It's a big business in many ways to have guns available. We also have what is apparently a lot of research that's pointing in all kinds of different directions in terms of trying to figure out, is there a correlation between having guns in the home and domestic violence, or is it really the case where if everybody has a gun, then everybody's going to be safer or not? What we do know is that of the 30-some-odd thousand gun-related deaths in the United States, over half of them involve suicides by gun. And as we take a look at the state of Alaska, and in particular the valley here, I suspect that our decisions about this and our discussion will be different than other places. You know, in a related fashion, and maybe this is something that Terry would want to respond to, we've recently seen the local school district take a closer look at a couple things. One, the plans that are in place in order to make sure that everything that is possibly done can be done to counter any attempt to do a similar thing that happened in Newtown. And also, in a related, or perhaps somewhat related, arena, the hiring of substitute teachers has come into focus. It's been probably a surprise to people that if you graduate from high school, you can turn around that fall and you can become a substitute teacher. And so this has, because of an individual who was recently extradited or is in the process of being extradited because of a crime committed, an alleged crime committed elsewhere, who was a substitute teacher here in the school district. Some changes have occurred that make it more difficult to become a substitute teacher. In one sense, you have to have at least 3 years between high school graduation and acting as a substitute teacher. And the whole process of background checking and interviewing has been centralized, so it's no longer a dispersed function, among other things. Terry, any comments about that?
Well, I think I totally agree with Charlie. This is just a really complex subject. You know, there's just been an enormous amount of information that's been spilled out over the Internet since this tragedy, and it is making people take a second look, and it's also bringing some information to the forefront that we probably haven't thought about too much, and the relation to gun lobbyists, to the NRA, and the relation to people that are elected to the NRA, and all kinds of, you know, things. I read some articles today talking about, you know, we've spent an amazing amount of money on combating terrorism in this country, and more people die by gun a year than, you know, not even in a small proportion to the terrorists in the country. So we've spent a lot of money preventing some things, but other things are really sort of a threat to our society. But, you know, Alaska is a different beast, as you pointed out, Mike. And because of a lot of isolation up here, people travel. A lot of the laws concerning transportation of weapons that have been loosened have been very have been good for Alaskans because we travel a lot. I think change will come pretty slowly here. And you can always, you know, follow the money. And there's a lot of people in this state that make a lot of money on guns. And to stop that flow of money will be a hard nut to crack. As far as the school district, I think the school district has been pretty proactive with this. But then having said that, you know, it would seem that school was pretty proactive, too, that underwent this tragedy in Connecticut. So, unfortunately, some of these things don't play out until the tragedy hits. And what you can count on is, you know, some sector of the people that will want to overreact and some will want to underreact. And hopefully we'll find the sweet spot in the middle so that we're all protected. But you're talking about some big cultural changes when it comes to people with their guns. And there's going to be a lot more conversation about this.
Right. Okay. Charlie?
Well, you know, you can't own a machine gun. And there's not a whole lot of difference between an assault rifle and a machine gun in terms of what it'll do, what it'll kill. Now, if you think that, I mean, I'm a gun owner. I have a number of guns. I don't have an assault rifle, don't own one, don't need one. But if you think that, if you have doubts about whether there are people out there that shouldn't have assault guns, all you have to do is read enough letters to the editor or listen to talk radio and listen to the irrational people out there, and I think you'll come to the conclusion that there's a lot of people that should not have assault weapons.
Right, right.
And that may be the most important point of this. I think the real question in my mind has to do with the difference between premeditated use, where you calculatedly and coldly plan to do something, you do it, versus the passionate in the moment use of an instrument such as a gun.
And if you're willing to die in the process of the crime that you're committing, then there's not a whole lot that can be done unless you're stopped on the way to perform it. I mean, if you're willing to, I mean, and how many of the last three or four have shot themselves?
Okay.
Right. And it's hard to square in my mind that adding even more guns to the equation is going to help anything. And there's also a part of the economy is that a lot of the guns that come in, what I'm reading anyway, that are assault-type weapons, which is kind of something that the NRA worked on, is getting that as part of an assault hunting rifle as opposed to a machine gun. But they're are brought here from China, and they're brought here from Germany and other countries. So we're importing an amazing amount of guns. And they're going through third world countries from our country as well. So, I mean, there is a huge economy of scale here that there's going to be a big fight on closing that down, I think. And it would seem, or it looks like the amount of hunters or sport hunters, which everybody kind of goes to because they think of their mom and dad and their grandpa, you know, deer hunting or moose hunting, and they don't want to take that ability away from their kids. But really, as far as registration or people that are the hunting community has gone way down statistically. People are doing other things. Kids are watching video games. They're really not using guns for hunting like they were in the 60s, say. So, you know, it's a limited amount of a lot of people that have them, a limited amount that use them, and they don't always use them well.
Well, there's paranoia about a slippery slope. You know, if you take away assault rifles now, mm-hmm. they'll be after my hunting rifle next.
Right.
And that is absolutely not true. It's not going to happen.
Right.
Well, what we've identified, I think, accurately, is the complicated nature of this. Just a perusal of today's Frontiersman, or for that matter, a look out there, any of the talk that's going on, that a significant number of people have addressed this issue, and they've used one version or another of what you've just said. It's complicated. You can select out one piece or another, but this has been an issue that's been with us for a long, long time. There have been other instances where you've had large-scale shootings in schools, for that mm-hmm. matter, in Stockton, California, for example, which was the reason, it is said, that legislation originally was passed that you referenced earlier, Charlie, that prohibited assault rifles.
And we had one in Bethel, Alaska.
Sure.
You know, we've had them. We just haven't had them in closer to home.
And possibly that's one thing. This event has certainly captured. Certainly for the moment and perhaps a bit longer, people's attention, and we'll see how that will go. What we do know is that at one level, and that is the level, the national level, there seems to be a continuing difficulty in having conversation, and a conversation where the agreement can be made in order for legislation that can be massaged and brought forth can actually be passed. So I'm going to segue here because recently we've had an attempt to negotiate a solution to what is referred to as the fiscal cliff. But it's a change in a number of programs, change in tax status and expenditures that's due to happen on the 1st of January. And for many listeners, just a reminder that was negotiated as a way of using a stick to get people together to talk. Either the stick got lost or something, but most recently out of Washington, D.C., comes the idea that we've not been able, one side in particular, the Speaker of the House, was not able to get his people in line to agree on a position that could be part of that negotiation. So right now we seem to be getting closer and closer to the 1st of January, whatever that would mean. With that shadow over us, what we have closer to home is the governor, since last Friday, revealing his budget and directing large sums of money toward the valley, in particular toward large projects. They in part involve road projects. They involve something for the dam, something for a bridge. Any sense of looking out at that and saying, okay, looks like big sums of money, but there's also a large decline projected in the amount of money that's going to be available this year in the state's budget?
Well, I think the personally, I think the governor sees the handwriting on the wall. They've got a valley senator as speaker, or a House president or Senate president. They've got you know, Mr. Dunleavy, who's new to the Senate on finance, they've got some pretty powerhouse legislators there. And I think what the governor knows, which is that they'll probably be able to split the pie up pretty good on those little projects, too, with the power that's sitting there. But, you know, having said that, everybody was jumping up and down when Sarah Palin was elected, thinking the valley was going to come out smelling like a rose, and it really didn't turn out that way. Now, I haven't compared last year's governor's budget to this one, but I think even though there is substantial money in there and big projects, I don't know that it's not as much as there was in there last year for the valley, I don't think. And, you know, it's Palmer got is receiving money for, you know, a water repair that's long needed here, but Wasilla wasn't mentioned in there. So I have to think that the governor sees that the people in the valley that will, the legislators in the valley will fill up some of those holes, backfill some of those holes, and, you know, for a more balanced budget. But that's, you know, the crystal ball effect.
Okay. All right. Charles, do you want to throw in anything at all on this?
I'm still waiting for the widening of the Palmer-Wasilla Highway all the way.
Okay, and anyone who drove that today, and I was privileged to do it, will know just what you mean.
Is that ever on the horizon?
It is, but it's a far horizon. This is probably one of the major issues associated. We know that Kinnick-Goose Bay as a road is targeted for some improvement. We know that the Parks Highway going north out of Wasilla is a very important route, and that's being worked on. We also know that the extension of the Bogard Road from Wasilla on over here to the Glen is an aspect of things. We have the Glen itself, which needs work. And then we have finishing of the Trunk Road, which is already in progress, and. So we could go on with a whole bunch of roads. And when you total all that up, it comes to a large sum of money, big projects. And that's not even talking about the real big projects like the rail extension, the Susitna Dam, or the bridge.
Well, you know, I think you kind of have to take the Susitna Dam and the bridge out of that because that's planning money. That's not infrastructure readily this project's going to go. But if you also recall, we had a flood this year, and it was there's going to be money coming in from both the federal and the state government for bridge repairs and roads repairs and some infrastructure that isn't contained in this budget. We also, as taxpayers, passed the $32 million road bond. And so those projects are on there. None of that will appear on the governor's budget, not to mention the $215 million school bond. So, you know, there's if you looked at all the pieces together, there's a lot of infrastructure projects there. I mean, the governor has decided to fund some planning in his, you know, way of planning, and that's the dam and the bridge. But there's only certain people that will benefit from those, and those are the people that are the planning team doing that, scoping it out and surveying that sort of thing. And those projects, you know, will take money to build. And that's what's the hard part, is getting the money together to build. And then there's the natural gas, the gas line. What route will that take, if there is one? And will it come through Matsu? And so there's a lot of more questions than answers, I think, from the governor's budget.
Well, Terry, now that you've brought up the gas pipeline, we noticed that a number of people, particularly from the local electrical utility, have raised the specter of the need to import fuel in order for the new power plant, for example, in Kootenai, to be powered, or others as well. The governor has, in his plan, supported an interesting approach, which is to truck gas in liquid form down from the North Slope to Fairbanks, and then, if necessary, on the rest of the way. Charles, you've had a little bit of time up there in on the North Slope, arguably dealing with oil, but any comments about this whole process of finding a way to get all that gas down here?
I have always thought that we should export gas, liquefied and exported. We should have had it built 10 years ago, and we'd be in pretty good shape right now if we had done that. if you were to look at the profile of Alaska, not knowing anything about it, and just with what the resources we got, you would expect that Alaska would be a place that had cheap electricity and cheap gas. And we should have. And if we did, all the other businesses we have would boom here. I mean, this would be a place of incredible growth. And I think that it's complete political stupidity that we don't have access to gas right now. Truck it down, I mean, whatever it takes so we don't run out. But I think we should build a pipeline right into Valdez or down here somewhere and build a liquefaction plant.
Okay. Well, a number of people have pointed out that if that had been done, as you suggested, would have begun some years ago, would be paying off now, because it would appear that there are foreign entities that would pay handsomely and far more.
Well, we could have made an incredible deal with the Japanese. The Japanese need electricity. They need fuel. They can't put those reactors back online. We could have made a deal. They could have sold us half of the pipe. It would have been a win-win on both places.
Well, there are people that are still, and so that's an interesting question as we look forward to this next legislature, whether there will be any further action. There have been a number of proposals. Obviously, the one through Canada has not gained much traction. We've had other ideas about how to do it, a small line, a big line, a bullet line, this line. Bottom line is there is no line, and it doesn't look like there's one coming very soon. Okay. Well, let's swing to another event that occurred. It seems like as soon as we speak here, we are a catalyst for other things to happen. And what we did have revealed last week was that as a result of an investigation by a group assigned to do that kind of thing for the legislature, a legislative aide for newly elected Shelley Hughes, representative from the Palmer area, that legislative aide was terminated. And it seemed the option was either the legislature would do it, or Representative Hughes would ask her to resign and fire her. And that's what happened. The interesting part of that, and this involves Representative Hughes' predecessor, former Representative Gatto, because it was at his behest that a bill, HB 88, was offered, and in apparently a discussion at the Frontiersman, which was the subject of an editorial in the Frontiersman, Representative Gatto suggested that that bill, HB 88, had no connection to an anti-Sharia position. Subsequently, there were people that suggested that it may have had that, and the legislative aide was apparently involved in allowing a representative from an anti-Sharia organization to use the LIO offices in support of that bill and that action. Any comments?
I think anti-Sharia legislation is ideological paranoia, period.
Okay, that's succinct. Terry?
Well, I think as far as the firing of Ms. Sawyer, I mean, I think this incident, to me, is more questions than answers again, because I wonder if Mr. Gatto was still in that seat and whether this would have continued on. I mean, how long did it continue on, and really, how many people knew? To me, I wonder if other activities are going on that everybody's just kind of walking by and shaking their heads. But, you know, for now, this is the answer, and is it the answer to a bigger question of, you know, what's being done on behalf of the taxpayer, the taxpayer's dollar, that is not quite appropriate, or is this just an insulated, you know, one incident that they've extinguished for now?
And of course,
tough way for Ms. Hughes to start out her her tenure there.
But that seems to be true. And, of course, you draw a straight line between another event where back some years ago, then-Representative Ethan Berkowitz raised a question mm-hmm. about the passing of notes on the House floor, which seemed to be an obvious no-no and had gone on until someone stepped up and said, what's going on? And so the bigger question, and it's one that's been discussed at varying levels, both at the borough and other places, how do you provide some assurance that this kind of ethical violation, whether it's on the House floor or in an LIO office, can be prevented? You know, what kinds of things work at that?
Well, I mean, you know, the obvious one is you vote people in that are ethical. but that's a tall order when you have 17% of your electorate show up to cast a vote. It is sort of the fox watching the hen house. You have to have legislators down there that are willing to speak up and probably risk something they want to do by catching the ire of their fellow legislators by pointing out that something's not particularly proper. I think you brought up that the Ethan Berkowitz thing. I think it's interesting, and I have pointed out a couple of times that the last time both the Senate and House was controlled by one party was in 2006, and that was the year of ECO, and now we have the same thing. I've always said that I think that people want balance. They want people that are there for different interests, but that can come together for a common interest. And I don't know that we have that right now. So this may be just the sunlight hitting an open window right now, and we'll just have to see what marches down in January. There certainly is more technology out there than there used to be capturing things, but they operate on a whole different level than smaller governments do. They don't have an Open Meeting Act that applies to legislators. We do. And that makes it a little problematic to really find out what's going on because so much goes on behind closed doors.
Well, that's true. Well, let's finish up with a little bit of a reference to something that happens in the open. Recently, the city of Palmer completed its budget negotiations, had a meeting. And at that meeting, there was a lot of time devoted toward an open discussion about what seemed at first to be a simple thing. Should the mayor have an assistant or not? Any comments about that, Terry?
Well, I still have to listen to the tape, but it's disappointing. It's disappointing that it certainly seems from at least secondhand that I've heard that it really fell down behind around party lines there and a struggle for power within the council. And there's a lot of work to be done by these small governments. And when they get wrapped around that axle, no good comes from it. So I think the Palmer Post had a really good article on it. It's gone around, and maybe a little bit of pressure will be put on the folks that sit on the council to straighten up on that and get to the people's business and not be... We spend a lot of time fighting back and forth about, it seems like, in comparison, small pockets of money, and we spend a lot of money on process. Nobody ever wants to point that out, really, that the cost of the process is part of the project. And so we'll see how that shakes out.
Okay. Well, thank you. Charles, any last words?
I don't think so.
Okay. We've got big, what appear to be very, very large topics that I'm sure are going to be continued to be dealt with. And one of those involves the place of guns in our world. We have what appear to be smaller topics, but maybe revealing of some large issues as well at various government meetings. So, Terry, any comments?
I just hope everybody has a Merry Christmas and we can all kind of turn the noise on off for a few days and enjoy family and friends and we'll see you after the holiday.
I second that.
All right. Well, out into what is a very noisy world with the wind still blowing at well over 40 miles per hour. Be back next week.